I think this quite revolutionary, paradigmatic shifts that we've seen with the digitalization, starting in the 90s with the internet and then with smartphones, and now we're on the threshold of artificial intelligence, harbors so many fantastic opportunities.
This is Jakob Hellgren, director of the Swedish Institute for International Affairs.
It has made us richer. It has, in many ways, made us much more happy. It has connected us more.
And the digital revolution also has some democratic advantages.
People's voices have been heard in a completely different and new way. Who could get access directly to a politician, and who could sit without outside a parliament and all of a sudden, after a couple of months, get millions of followers pleading an important issue? So I think better access to information and knowledge, governmental agencies becoming more transparent is another thing, which is, of course, important for democracy. And with this connectivity, I think more people-to-people relations are a result of this digital revolution.
There's no doubt we are all more connected thanks to digital tools. We get so much information that we are hyper-alert to the current state of the world around us. On the one hand, the use of digital technologies can in many ways benefit international peace, security and democracy, as Jakob suggests. But the same technologies can also pull us apart through the spread of disinformation, propaganda and fake news, or through censorship. And haven't we all had the experience of ending up in echo chambers or so-called filter bubbles, where we only communicate with people we already agree with? In this episode, we ask how we can use digital tools to advocate for peace and democracy. What kind of challenges and opportunities does the digital media landscape present for democratic societies? And what is the future of democracy worldwide in the era of digitalization? I'm Josefine Volkwarts, and you're listening to the Nordic Talks podcast.
Digital technology is oftentimes called as liberation technology. And I myself believe in that.
This is Maiko Ichihara. She's an associate professor at the Graduate School of Law at Hitotsubashi University in Tokyo, Japan.
This digitalization or technology actually empowers the citizens or individuals in this entire world in a way that they can actually make positive or substantial impact onto the international scene. I think that's one of the reasons how people actually can make the scene of the international issues much more complicated in a way that we ought to avoid having simplified sort of, thinking.
Along with Jakob, Maiko is participating in a Nordic Talks event at the University of Creativity in Tokyo, arranged by the Nordic embassies in Japan. And Jakob is quick to respond to Maiko's assessments.
I really like the word liberation technologies, empowering people, because that's what it's about in many ways. And it just made me think about Greta Thunberg, who essentially started a social movement, which wouldn't have been so strong if it weren't for the digital tools and instruments. And that has become a great force for green transition and to holding politicians account. And there's been many other similar initiatives.
Speaking of driving change through technology, our speakers get into a conversation about the Russian war in Ukraine. You see, shortly after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Ukrainians were provided with Starlink, a high-speed internet service covering the whole country. This meant new possibilities.
There's, of course, a lot of terrible things happening there. But on the positive side, since we're starting with that, just think of Starlink, how Elon Musk provided access to all Ukrainians, both for the warfighting effort, but also for the people-to-people relations. That's quite amazing, isn't it?
Michael has another example related to the war in Ukraine.
In the aftermath of the Russian aggression into Ukraine, the NGO called Squad 303 in Poland created this internet platform where individual citizens from all over the world actually can spread information about what's going on in this war to Russian citizens. So, you know, by this NGO's work of creating this network or platform, individual citizens get involved to help the Ukrainians or in the country Ukraine to sort of fight against the Russians in a way that Russian people can actually have access to the truth, so that they try to, you know, judge what's right and what's wrong, you know, whether Russian aggression is indeed something that they can support.
Yeah, hello everyone. I hope that you hear me very well, and really my apologies that I can't be there, but I'm happy that you have invited me to join this meeting this way. Thank you.
This is Rauno Merisar, and as you can hear, he's joining us online. He's a human rights ambassador at the Finnish Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and Rauno has listened to Jakob and Michael and agrees that freedom of speech and information are the most important things to fight for.
Being able to express yourself is one of the most important things in the world. It allows you to communicate your hopes and dreams, relate you to the others, engage with the big issues of our times, and create change.
Another example of citizens working to share information with the wider world is the organization Bellingcat. This is an independent collective of investigative researchers and journalists brought together by a passion for open source research. They were founded back in 2014, and they pioneered the use of open source research methods to investigate a variety of subjects of public interest. These range from the shooting down of flight MH17 over eastern Ukraine to police violence in Colombia and the illegal wildlife trade in the United Arab Emirates.
People from very different backgrounds actually get together online and then, look for this picture, that information, that, Google map kind of things, and then try to match what actually happened when this, for example, plane clashed or things like that. So those things have been empowering us by both providing more information to the world and also receiving more information through the internet.
The gathering of documentation is not only important for the public debate, it's also crucial for future prosecutions against those responsible for atrocities.
What is happening in Ukraine now is, of course, horrendous. War crimes are being committed. And we saw that already in the Syria conflict, how digital video clips can be used as evidence for future processes, legal processes, indicting people and holding war criminals accountable. Sweden actually has such a legal possibility to indict people for extrajudicial crimes committed outside Swedish territory. And I heard recently how the prosecutors there have, you know, their work is becoming easier because there is a lot of digital material out there. So these are positive uses of digitalization in difficult circumstances that I come to think of.
One additional thing to mention would be the anonymity that technology actually allows us. In the current international scene, democracy has been repressed in all over the world, and people are suffering so much by the limitation in terms of freedom of media, freedom of speech, freedom of academia, and so forth. But this anonymity actually gives the people spread the truth into the world. And so, for example, in Myanmar, people started this citizen journalism right after the coup occurred. And so even when those journalists are repressed and not being able to, you know, spread the news. People, you know, street people can take pictures, share it on Twitter and spread what's happening in the country. So and this is a really powerful tool, I think.
As we've heard, there's no doubt that digitalization can be crucial when advocating for peace and democracy. But it comes with challenges as well. Michael wants us to take a step back.
In the past, before the arrival of the internet, we had only like newspapers, magazines, or governmental publications where people could actually express what they thought or information. And average people did not actually have the access to whatever publications. They did not have the place to sort of show their opinion in the public. But with the arrival of the internet, they finally had gained this access to the platform. But unfortunate thing, I think, is that while people think, we think that, the public was visualized, we became realized that, public actually had opinions and, ideas and so forth. But they are actually within the filter bubble, echo chamber effect. And what the people are perceiving in front of them are actually only the opinion within filter bubbles. And so, it became really difficult to realize that there are different types of opinions or different types of discussions going on within the Twitter space, even if you do not get to see it. So I think that's a sort of difficult part.
And that is reinforced by algorithms, which we do not have control over, which I think is an interesting discussion as well.
These negative sides of digitalization and social media networks are especially a problem given the threats to democracy in many parts of the world.
The current situation right now in the entire world is very much concerning for the democracy, for the democratic societies. A lot of coups are happening, a lot of election interference are happening, populists are mobilizing the people, and it's becoming very difficult to understand what's the truth. And in this, those extreme things go viral, and if some extreme crime happens, and that goes viral, and some coup happens somewhere, that goes viral, some stupid people appear, then that goes viral. That's making each issue's attention span really, really short. And so I think we really have to think how to keep the attention on each very important topics.
There are definitely both pros and cons to the digital revolution we've experienced during the last decades. But right now, the world is on a threshold of what might be yet another revolution as we enter the era of artificial intelligence, or AI, like ChatGPT, for instance. And the question is whether it's necessary to buckle up before we set off on this new digital journey.
Possibilities and challenges and even threats of the ChatGPT is also discussed here a lot. I haven't tried it yet by myself, but when I told to my colleague that I'm going to take part in this discussion, he sent me as a joke a text created by the ChatGPT and using the keywords democracy, technology, and Finland. And I must say that, yes, it was full of clichés, but it didn't include any big mistakes. So the ChatGPT seems to know very well that we highlight the rule of law, accountability, transparency, dialogues, digital literacy, and so forth. So, but after all consideration, I decided to use my own little brains too, and I hope that you are fine with that. But a bit more seriously, we cannot separate every single solution from each other. So the legislation must treat equally all and be predictable, and our policy must be balanced so that it also enables technological development, but at the same time, of course, respect all fundamental and human rights. So I don't think that there will be any that kind of legal restrictions for that system so far. What comes to the safety belt, so I think that we already have them quite a lot when we think about the International Human Rights Conventions covering also this, the digital world, and different policies. Of course, we have to improve these things, and there are many things ongoing, for instance, here in Europe by the Council of Europe and the European Union as well.
But is the development going too fast? Can the legislation keep up? And what about us human beings?
I think this is a fascinating and somewhat scary subject. You could say, as I said in the beginning, adding internet and smartphones and AI, lumping that together, you could absolutely say that we're in an industrial revolution taking us to new level. And normally I would say that technology is neutral. It's how you use it. But when I think about it, AI, I hope it's going to stay neutral, actually, because what we hear now more and more from those who are actually developing AI, which is essentially private companies, huge private companies with quite limited government influence. Well, you could argue that all technological revolutions comes from inventors and companies, but they themselves are starting to talk about, well, maybe we need a 6 months moratorium. I saw an op-ed recently in The Economist saying that we need an international agency regulating the use of AI, just as we in the 1950s agreed on the International Atomic Energy Agency, because where this is going is scary. And that is from the people who are developing this. And that makes me a little bit worried, because when you talk about legislation, I mean, as democracies, what we care about is, of course, personal integrity, human rights, using it to protect our citizens. Maybe the International Human Rights Conventions is enough as a legal instrument. Maybe not, because the authoritarian states, I'm quite sure, will want to use AI, because that's what they've done with internet, to repress, to surveil, and maybe to track dissidents and control political thinking. So I think we are at a quite an interesting threshold at the moment. And this is also a debate that is happening in Sweden right now.
Well, for authoritarian actors, they are interested in conducting surveillance to their citizens, and thus how to get the citizens' data has been an issue for them, and that has been one of the reasons why, for example, China has been exporting AI surveillance technology to other countries. So far, more than 80 countries have received China's AI technology, surveillance technologies, for surveillance. And this has been conducted proactively, but with the arrival of ChatGPT, even without installing those surveillance technologies and proactively trying to get people's private information, private people themselves actually insert their information to conduct a search in ChatGPT, and there is a possibility that those private information actually gets leaked unintentionally by other people, or maybe intentionally, can make them make the ChatGPT leak those private information. So there is a really serious sort of change in terms of how we can protect human rights in this era, and I think one additional sort of interesting aspect in here is how these ChatGPT type of AI technology can be utilized to counter authoritarian actors. For example, China has been blocking the use of ChatGPT, being afraid that ChatGPT might talk about the Tiananmen Square incident or, you know, whatever repression that the government has been conducting.
All this raises the question how the rest of us ordinary citizens must act. Could we prepare ourselves through education, for example?
Well, I think education is paramount, and more precisely, source criticism. We all learned about that at school. Primary sources, secondary sources, what do we trust? And with AI, I think that it's becoming more acute because fakes and deep fakes and whatever it's called are becoming more and more difficult to distinguish. So maybe we should even recall to ourselves about the 16 cognitive biases that we, and which of them we are most, we're challenging with most each of us. So I think this is incredibly important. And maybe, the echo chambers, I think we tend to forget that we all live in our respective filter bubbles and echo chambers reinforced by those darn algorithms, maybe challenging ourselves to remember that, maybe leaving them. So all of that, more precisely, I think is important when it comes to education. And it should start in primary school, because who is using this the most and who is, you know, the younger generations are more and better at using this.
In Rauno's home country, Finland, education in this field is already a hot topic.
This is really something we have paid attention to. We are a small nation, and that's why we need the people and also younger generation who is skilled and highly educated. Maybe here the thing is that we shall offer high level education, including digital and media literacy, to all children. So also to those who are the most vulnerable situations. So they could be also somewhere more vulnerable to mis and disinformation as well. So this is something we really have to look at. As Jacob mentioned, this kind of phenomenon-based education is some way taking more room also in Finnish classrooms. So the children and youth are encouraged to seek information themselves, and they must be critical. And we believe that this is also the good way to somewhere to combat disinformation as well. But again, the right to education belongs to all children, and we have to offer the high-level education to all children to be successful.
I would also say that the young generation is actually digital natives, while we are not. And so we also have to learn from them, and we also have to try to work with them, not as an unequal partner between, you know, them and us, but well, as an equal, or maybe, well, you know, well, superior partner, I'm not sure. But that's one thing. And what we have to do, I think, includes not only, literacy education is very important, primary important. And after then, we also have to think about fact-checking of disinformation and misinformation. Fact-checked articles actually does not travel well, because it gets into the stuck into the filter bubble, and also it talks a lot about truth and facts, while it does not convey so much emotion in it. And so I think we, the people in the democratic societies, have to think about really how to create counter narratives, which goes against those authoritarian actors, domestically and internationally, that are trying to create this narrative which harms democratic values and norms. And for that sake, I think young generation also has something to add as well. We together can analyze What kind of targets those authoritarian actors are trying to influence, and with what kind of methods they are trying to do so. And by understanding those things, we can think about what kind of counter narratives would work the best. And that's how we can actually talk about the virtues of human rights, democracy, and peace.
At the same time, there are also signs that authoritarian regimes, while abusing the possibilities of digitalization, are equally afraid of these new and constantly evolving tools.
I actually do think that digitalization affects the authoritarian states quite a lot. Think of how they are shielding themselves from the dangerous ideas of, freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, and freedom to criticize your rulers. I mean, they are becoming more and more closed. China is closing itself from the outside, internet world for a reason, and they are adapting. Just think of North Korea. They don't want these even balloons. With human rights messages, so I think they feel that they are under pressure, and the digital instruments are, I think, part of that. This doesn't mean that it will change all. It doesn't mean that they won't counteract, and quite strongly so.
In other words, the struggle between democracy and dictatorship is also very much a digital struggle.
In Europe, I think, you have this, Russian aggression into Ukraine right now, which is such a big topic to cover. And so Europe is doing a really great job in, shedding light on this. Then I think we have to think about what to do in Asia. Well, we actually have this Hong Kong losing, freedom, Myanmar losing freedom, Thailand, India, Indonesia, the Philippines, almost all those countries are suffering a lot. And we Asians are the ones to shed light on what's going on in those countries, not only in Ukraine and Russia or, European, what's going on in Europe.
No matter where we are in the world, a digital revolution is taking place. And as we've heard today, technological progress can undermine peace just as well as promote it. Dictators are becoming better at navigating the digital world, spreading propaganda and exercising control. But equally, they feel threatened by it. For those of us who stand up against them, advocating for peace and democracy is a matter of using all possibilities to get access to information, to make important connections, and to spread the word of democracy while watching out for fake news and disinformation. We also need to stay tuned on new developments within tech, including the integration of artificial intelligence in our everyday lives. I'm Josefine Folkvarts. Thank you for listening to the Nordic Talks podcast. Do you want to organize your own Nordic Talks event? Then check out nordictalks.com/producer. I'm Josefine Folkvarts. Thanks for listening.